Haunted Nights, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.
Everybody, first things first, we'd like to thank W.J. Pierce for creating and performing our music. Good evening and welcome to Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. We're your hosts, Alistair Cross, and I'm here with my co-host and collaborator, Tamara Thorne. How are you today, Tamara?
I'm fine, Alistair. I sure had fun today with that scene, didn't you?
Yeah, you're
you know,
dirty. And
that one everybody's going to think, everybody's going to think it's you.
Exactly.
That's right, get it. And also, my pussy cat is grabbing me today. He's got all his paws in my hand, and he's making me pet his belly. So how are you?
I'm good. All right. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Before we introduce tonight's guest, I'm going to give it to you, Tamara, and you can tell them what's going on in our world.
Okay. Well, that would be Ravencrest that we want to talk about, which has to do with that dirty thing we wrote today. So let me tell you all about it. In a remote part of California, Ravencrest Manor, imported stone by stone from England more than two centuries ago, looms tall and terrifying, gathering its dark and unnatural powers and drawing those it wants as its own. You're supposed to laugh right here, maniacally. Thank you. In Exorcism, Book 3 of the Ravencrest Saga, something evil is stirring in the deep, dark waters of the estate's indoor pool as ghostly jazz age parties fill the air with phantom music. Within the mansion, a maid is visited nightly by a demon lover, and Governess Belinda Moreland is haunted by the tormented spirit of Violet LeBlanc, a silent movie star who was driven mad in her prime and wants Belinda to help her in her search for justice. The Ravencrest Saga series is first released in serialized installments, and the first two episodes, Begotten and Incubus, are available now on Amazon. The third one is coming soon. In fact, it came a whole lot today, to be honest with you. Alistair?
It did. Also, if you need to brush up on the Ravencrest Saga, you can get the first two full volumes on Amazon in ebook and a paperback. That is The Ghosts of Ravencrest and The Witches of Ravencrest. Both are available now. All right, again, you're listening to Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. You can learn more about what we do at our websites, alistaircross.com and tamarathorn.com, or you can visit our mutual blog at thornandcross.wordpress.com. If you tweet, you can hook up with us at @crossalistair and @tamarathorn. You can also visit our Haunted Nights Live page on Facebook. For more information on the show, you can visit Authors on the Air on Facebook, Twitter, and at authorsontheair.com. This is a broadcast of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. All right. Without further ado, tonight's guest, we're very excited to have Robert Masello. He is an award-winning journalist and one of the first who have been insulted to his face by Donald Trump, which he wears
Yay.
As a badge of honor. A veteran television writer whose credits include Charmed, Sliders, and Poltergeist the Legacy, and a best-selling novelist whose many novels have been regularly optioned by Hollywood studios. His newest, The Night Crossing, was published just last week. Publishers Weekly held it as interesting alternate history in which Masello creatively reimagines the inspiration for Dracula with thrills, frights, and a splendid final confrontation aboard the Titanic. Bram Stoker and Mina Harcourt set off on a harrowing mission through the darkest districts and most desolate workhouses of Victorian London to put an end to a deeply embedded evil. Think Charles Dickens meets Stephen King, with mummies, mysterious golden boxes, ancient curses, and one of the worst maritime disasters in recorded history. All right, a native of Chicago, Robert studied writing under the famed novelist Robert Stone and Jeffrey Wolfe at Princeton University, and now lives the wild bachelor life close to the beach in Santa Monica. Without further ado, please welcome Robert Masello. How are you, Robert?
I'm fine, thank you. Of course, now I just want to hear that selection from Ravencrest that you were alluding to earlier. That sounds pretty hot.
How's that? Yeah, we'll send it to you tomorrow when we send you the permanent link to this podcast.
Please do.
Yeah, yeah.
We need to know how you were one of the first insulted by Trump.
Right.
This is way back when I was a journalist in New York in the 1980s, uh-huh. and I was assigned by Town and Country magazine to do a long profile of Donald Trump, who at that point was just, you know, a real estate developer, you know, in New York and building a couple of hotels and the Trump Tower, of course. Mm-hmm. And I'll make it short. I went to interview him, and he was, of course, leaning back in a chair on like a white phone with a big desk the size of an aircraft carrier. And I kept asking him questions that he was giving me kind of rote answers because he'd done so many interviews. And I thought, I got to write a long profile of this guy. I got to get him interested. So I finally said, did you get into real estate because your family was already in real estate, or did you get into it because you had an innate interest? And that's when he finally, like, focused on me. And he said, when I got out of Wharton, I had friends who went into stuff like entertainment and banking. There's no serious money there. There's only two places to make serious money, oil and real estate. And that's when I said, well, and freelance writing being the third. That's what got his attention. And he looked at me and said, yeah, take a guy like you. You seem like a smart guy. What a stupid decision. What are you ever going to have? And for the next 5 or 10 minutes, he proceeded to paint a dismal portrait of my life, which also was scarily accurate. That's what bothered me. Because he's saying, if you have an apartment, it's probably a dump. I'm going, yeah, that's true. He goes, if you're driving a car, it's secondhand. I'm going, well, actually, I don't even have a car. And if you get a date, she's not going to be good looking. I'm going, actually, I've been going to the movies alone a lot lately. it was New York. Yeah, nobody had cars in New York except limos maybe picking you up and dropping you off. But that was back in like 1983. And so at least I can say I've actually spent time in the company of an American president. I wish I could have chosen differently, but there we have it.
Wow.
I don't know. You think I can spin a novel out of that somehow? I don't know.
Oh, I'll bet.
Well, you might. You might. Wow. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. I put it on my Match.com profile, one of the first to be insulted to his face by the president, so.
Speaking of the 80s, you and I probably go back almost that far. Boy, the 90s anyway.
I think we met in right when I got here, which was 1991, actually, is when I got to California.
That's when
New York.
First book came out, so it had to be a book signing, probably Dark Delicacies.
Could have been Dark Delicacies. Or there was also, it's where I met some other people that we both know. There was a little used bookstore and new, and it was in Santa Monica. I don't know if I met you there by any chance.
Oh, yeah. Could be.
I can't remember what it was called, but I used to go in there a lot. And, of course, now it's just, boy, the dearth of bookstores is just sad.
Yeah, it's Dark Delicacies. That's it. At least
Dark Delicacies is one of the great stalwarts, mm-hmm. All of us who write in this genre, worship at the altar of Del and Sue Howison, and we're so grateful to that store. I know I am. In fact, I put Del Howison in one of my books years ago as a character.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, it was a novel.
Wow.
I forget which one. I think it was Bestiary, but I had him in the book and described in that distinctive appearance of his,
Oh, yes. He has great hair.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
He has the best hair. Yeah. Boy. Boy, when we met, we were both doing book signings. This was before you started doing a lot of screen play or TV, what do you call it, teleplay?
Yeah. TV writing.
Screen editor. Yeah. And then you did that for a while, but I loved your books. I still do. And this new one, The Night Crossing, sounds absolutely fantastic.
I mean, I had done the television writing for a while, Charmed and Sliders and Poltergeist and stuff like that. And it's certainly lucrative, television writing. And that's really why you do it. But I'm not sure it was the most congenial space for me because there are different kinds of writers. Some are really into the collegial atmosphere. I'm sociable. I like being in a room, but if I'm in a room with a bunch of people, we're just telling stories, we're not getting work done. For me to write, sort of need to be alone and in my own space. And I'll admit I do like whatever story is being told. If I'm telling it, I like it to be told my way.
Sure. Yeah. It would be weird to write with a whole, Alistair and I write together every day, all day on Skype, but that's different. That's just two people. We mailed. It's very cool.
But even then, that's complicated. I mean, in television, there's like eight people, so it's really collaborative because, the network notes and the studio people, everybody gets involved. But even between, you and Alistair, it's still you both have to kind of do a mind meld of some kind, I'm sure.
Yeah, for us it's easy,
we do have freedom to kind of, go with whichever direction we kind of want to, which is, I think, that's kind of the part that I think would be hard for me about, like, television is you're kind of contributing to a world that's already been created, and that would be kind of tough, I think.
So
when I was writing for Charmed, I some of the best stuff I wrote, I just thought I have to toss out because it didn't sound like, it sounded like Noel Coward. It didn't sound like Alyssa Milano and Shannon Doherty would be saying these things to each other.
Yeah.
I'd go, gee, that's really witty badinage there, but I'm not sure they would engage in that, the characters are pretty much set.
Yeah. So funny.
Did you ever get to meet Alyssa Milano or Shannon Doherty or any of them?
Just kind of like in passing, I didn't really know any of the the cast is off shooting someplace, and you're the writer, so you're sitting in a room where they do nothing but bring in, kettle corn and Snickers bars and anything else sugared and caffeinated to keep you percolating. really, there's nothing that makes you fatter than working on a television show on staff. they keep you corralled in this windowless, airless room with nothing but they're bringing you cappuccinos. And really, in the middle of the table, there was always buckets filled with M&Ms and stuff like that. And you could only resist for so long.
Yeah. What show did you enjoy working on the most of those three?
Never been asked that. I wrote a bit also for like Early Edition and stuff, and that was a very good bunch of writers. That was the one where the guy got Tomorrow's Newspaper Today. Kyle Chandler starred in that one, as you may recall. It was all a matter of just finding a couple of congenial souls and Poltergeist Legacy. I was on that for a couple of years. Charmed, I was on more briefly. But each one, you have to come in and sort of master their universe and master their tone And again, you're writing to somebody else's pattern.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I write a book, and my books are pretty, outlandish sometimes in their premises. It's still mine to do. I mean, when I was suggesting to the publisher with The Night Crossing, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell the purportedly true story behind Dracula, the story that actually inspired Bram Stoker to later transmute those materials into Dracula. So they'd look at you cockeyed like, "You mean no vampires?" I'd go, "Exactly. It's Bram Stoker, but there's not going to be a vampire in sight anywhere." That's a hard sell, actually, because they're going, but Bram Stoker, it's vampires. You go, but this is the precursors. This is what made him think about that. And for somebody who's reading this book, I think it's actually, I hope, it's not for me to say, but the idea is that you read this book and the purportedly true story that I'm telling, which of course I'm making up, but along the way you find all of these clues and you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, that's what would later become this in the book and story of Dracula.
Oh, cool.
So that he really did, Bram Stoker, in his true life, knew a guy who was a real person named Arminius Vamberi, who was a Hungarian diplomat. He was very skilled in languages. He worked for the Foreign Office in England. He was a genius. And but he had the background in Transylvania and all of that, that in some respects he imparted, in some portions, he imparted to Bram Stoker. So you can see in that, like, oh, this is where Professor Van Helsing may have originated. In fact, if you read Dracula, the book, there's a shout-out to Arminius Vanbury in the book. It was almost like Bram Stoker saying, you know, hi there, but also like trying to throw people off the track, like, it's not Arminius, but of course it was. And you will see in the character of Mina Harcourt, you'll see a precursor to Mina Harker. You'll see in Lucinda Watts, Lucy Westenra, who was the victim of Count Dracula in the book. So, I mean, the idea is, if you've never read Dracula and don't know anything about it, and I don't know anybody in the world who's avoided it, you would still read this book, I hope, and be able to enjoy the adventure for what it is. But if you're a Dracula fan, you know, you'll keep coming across these little Easter eggs as you go, thinking, wait a minute, that sounds like something he would have later, you know, transformed into an element in the book. Because my book takes place in 1895, 2 years before Dracula was published. And then we do a time jump to 1912 for the final act, which is when the villains are aboard the first unsinkable ship on its maiden voyage, and Bram Stoker is able to track them onto it.
Very nice.
Yeah, I think it sounds great. We need to get copies of this. We've talked about this, and we've both decided we need to get copies of it. And I love Dracula, and I also read your book Blood and Ice, and I thought that had such a cool kind of Dracula vibe to it.
Yeah,
I love that.
I do too. History, science, and all that stuff. Neaty.
Well, yeah, that's kind of become, you know, to the extent that I have a niche at all, that's kind of it. I mean, I'm one of those writers who had a really hard time coming up with, and I wrote a bunch, but, you know, contemporary domestic stories set present day, you know, in New York where I used to live or in L.A. here. But, and when I stumbled upon the idea of, like, taking actual history and historical characters and then weaving stories around them and through them, it opened like a whole new world to me, and it was fun because I enjoy doing the research. You can get lost in it, which is a mistake, but I enjoy doing the research into the Titanic, for instance, and then figuring out how do my characters fit into that, you know, where are the scares, where are the plot twists, where are the plot turns, and just, you know, uncovering things along the way that I can then incorporate into the books. And I don't need to tell you guys, you know, truth is always stranger than fiction. You can't make up really some of the stuff you find.
Right now, it's true. It's true.
I did not know, for instance, the quandary that several of the society men were in when the Titanic was sinking, because they not only had to make sure that their wives and children with whom they were traveling on deck A got off safely, but they had their mistresses ensconced on deck C. And so they're like, excuse me, honey, I just got to run downstairs for just a minute. I know it's a bad time, but excuse me. I thought, I never thought of that angle. That's kind of interesting. I didn't know that they had that kind of extra burden.
Oh, I love it.
That's fantastic.
Oh, that's great.
When I was writing these books, you also, and you guys would know this, but you uncover so much contextual, coincidental stuff. Like the previous book to The Night Crossing was The Jekyll Revelation, and that was about Robert Louis Stevenson and the writing of The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, when that was made into a stage play in 1888 and opened at the Lyceum Theater in the West End of London, a theater that exists to this day, the theater manager there was Bram Stoker. I mean, Stevenson and Stoker met. And in those days, Stoker was still casting around, like, he was so envious of Robert Louis Stevenson for coming up with Jekyll and Hyde, and he was going, God, if only I could just come up with one really good idea like that.
great.
He was writing some crummy gothic tales for like little magazines and things, and Stoker published a collection of his own stories at his own expense called Under the Sunset. And oh my God, these stories were aimed at children, and it was supposed to be like a Christmas volume, as I recall. These are the grimmest, darkest, most despairing tales. I thought you read this to a child, he'd throw himself off the roof. I mean, it was just, and it did not have a great sale. It was illustrated and everything, so he was out of pocket on that. But Stoker was always looking for that one great idea, and he so envied people who'd had one, like Stevenson with Jekyll and Hyde.
Do you suppose he knew he had one with Dracula?
You know, it took him years actually to write it, and when the book came out, he got good reviews, but not over-the-top reviews. I mean, it was a mixed reception, generally favorable.
Mm-hmm.
But the book also, there was a moral backlash against the book, and for reasons that, you know, I don't hardly need to explain. I mean, you know, there are scenes in the book where, you know, Dracula is making a slash in his own breast and forcing a woman to suck the blood from the wound while the prostrate husband lies at the foot of the bed. I mean, this is steamy stuff for today, and for its era, this was scandalous. So there was some kind of, you know, certain amount of moral opprobrium that was attached to that book. And it took a while to sort of get going. And in fact, you know, it did fine for him, but what really helped it was, you know, was after he died in 1912, Bram Stoker, shortly after, in fact, the Titanic sank, which is what put that whole idea into my head. Was interesting to me that it was kind of the end of an age when the Titanic sank and Stoker went down shortly thereafter. And again, he was on his last legs then anyway, having had a stroke and all of that. But I don't know. I just thought that kind of wrapped it up neatly in a way. And it wasn't until 1922 when F.W. Murnau made Nosferatu that the book, interest in the book really revived, and Stoker's widow, Florence, in fact, sued for copyright infringement, and she won, and all of the prints of that film were supposed to have been destroyed. Fortunately, a couple of them made it through, which is why we can see Nosferatu today. But she won that lawsuit, and then in 1931, I think it was, you can check me on that, is when Bela Lugosi made the Universal Pictures version with her permission. And when Bela Lugosi did it, then it took off again. So Stoker didn't enjoy all of the success and riches that came from the book, but to some extent his widow did.
Wow. I'm glad she
did. I didn't know that. Right?
Right.
So I'm curious, though, when you were, you said that kind of put the idea in your head, the sinking of the Titanic and the death of Bram Stoker. Is that really when you got the idea for this? Because I mean, this is a really interesting. I don't think I ever would have. You know, I love Dracula. I'm a Dracula fanatic. I've probably read it a half a dozen times just in the last couple of years.
Oh, good.
And yeah, I love it. And I don't think I ever would have really thought. You know, I wonder what what inspired all this. And I mean, what is it that it's a lame question, but where did you get this idea to do it this way?
Well, no, I mean, for me, I want to deal with this material, and I'm always looking for a way to come at it from an angle that I can't think that it's been come at from. You know, it's and with something like Dracula, it's pretty hard to come. You know, there's over 170 Dracula movies, I think, out in the world already. So you're thinking, how do I reinvent this, or what do I add to this story? And I was interested in Bram Stoker, the actual person. I will say, and I share with you, Alistair, the fascination with that book. Dracula was the first book that I remember, and I always was reading scary stuff when I was a kid, you know, still do. But it was the first book I read where I distinctly remember pulling the chair I was reading in into the corner of the room so nothing could be behind me, And there was a light over my head, one of those Torchere kind of lamps. And I stuck that right behind the chair, but then I put it in the corner of the study, which was a very small room in my parents' house in Chicago. I mean, I was so scared. I couldn't stop reading it, but I was so scared by that book, I needed to be able to look around in all directions instantly with a bright light shining.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was the first one that, you know, when they're going through the Borgo Pass, I mean, that was enough. The hair on the back of my neck stood up.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, my childhood, my writing formative years are similar too, because I remember reading it when I was way, way, way too young. I didn't understand a lot of what was happening, and I remember getting to that scene where Dracula was climbing up the wall, and it freaked me out so bad. And it seriously, you know, to this day, I want to be that creepy, you know.
I know. All of us who write in this genre, we just think, if I could just scare somebody half as much as some of those scenes in that, or, you know, I mean, of course, I enjoyed Mary Shelley's Frankenstein a lot, too. And it always bugged me. I mean, my God, Boris Karloff was fantastic, but that's just not the creature in that book. You know, that's the creature in the book is articulate and eloquent, in fact, and delivers real speeches. And I was stunned when I went, oh, it's a mumbling monster, but that's not how Mary Shelley portrayed the creature.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I read Frankenstein when I was a lot older. I liked that too. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's also, I guess, there's something, I don't know why it is, but there's something like in The Night Crossing and you know, Blood and Ice also, and of course The Jekyll Revelation. I keep going back to the Victorian era. There is, let's just face it, there's just something about top hats and canes and cabriolets and gaslight, and that's spooky.
It's that atmosphere I love.
I mean, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote an essay, in fact, in favor of gas lamps. He didn't like the electric lighting that was going in because it was going to dispel so much of the mystique of London as he knew it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Much as the first LED lights made everything look terrible. Yeah.
I know, right?
Yeah.
True. No, I agree. I love Victorian horror. Were you a fan? Did you ever watch Penny Dreadful?
Yes, I watched a little of it, yes.
Yeah.
Did you care for it?
I didn't see the whole thing. I think it got a little crazy for me, and there was just too many. They were trying to pull everything into one tent, and it wasn't working for me at a certain point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt the same way. I was really excited about it, and I kind of lost interest after, you know, not too long. But
season
it was
one.
A great idea, I think.
Yeah. That was interesting.
All right, so. The Night Crossing, the one thing that I love about this, and I always point this out when I see this, I love the cover for this book. This is just so cool. Did you have any say in the cover, or is it just something someone did? And here you go, this is it.
I've even got a secret to tell you about the cover. Well, and on the hard cover, they sent me a box of them a few weeks ago because it's just out. And I did what every author does, quite naturally. I slept with a copy the first night. I'm not the only one who does this. And during the course of the night, because I'm a troubled sleeper, the cover, the jacket, slipped off, which is when I discovered that this book is so beautiful that they have printed another cover onto the cardboard, you know, the actual firm cardboard cover. And it's different. There is another graphic below it, which I would never have known was there. If you didn't remove the jacket, you wouldn't even know that it was another cover underneath it, which is also quite beautiful. I mean, they haven't done that for books since the 50s, you know. And so I was very pleased with that. And the publisher did consult with me on, what they do is they gave me several different covers and. What do you think? And I was able to. In fact, the cover that you're looking at was one they'd rejected. We'd gone through several, and we were going through permutations. And then my editor, who's a great guy, said, well, you know, there's one other that was passed on for some reason, and then he showed me that one, and I said, I like that one. And with a little bit of, you know, jiggering, we were able to make that one be the cover. Yeah. But all of the things suggest are good. I don't have much of an eye. I'm not good artistically, but I mean, all of theirs were good. This one was the one I thought was the most on point.
Yeah. No, it's gorgeous. I love it. I always just think, would I pick up a book based on the cover alone? Because I don't care what they say about judging books by their covers. Yes, we do. I do, and I'm usually right. Mm-hmm. but I see one that I'm like, I want to read it just because of the cover. I have to comment on it, and that's, I love this book cover. I love it.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
Well, they had done a study at some point years ago where they, back in the day when there were lots of bookstores, and they discovered that when people looking at a table of books, with all of them laid out, I think it was something crazy. It was like you had an eighth of a second, something like that, to snag an eyeball before the eye had moved on to the very next one. So, I'm always a big fan of simple covers with one strong impression, because that's of all you've really got time to make.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, so the Night Crossing came out just very recently. We wish you the best luck on it. We're looking forward to reading it. Before we let you go, could you tell the listeners where they can find out more about you and what you do and, of course, The Night Crossing?
Well, aside from going on Match.com, you can go to www.robertmasello.com. That's all one word, Robert and M-A-S-C-L-L-O. RobertMasello.com will get you to my website, which, oh my God, I just realized I do have to update. It's still years behind. We were discussing that earlier. And also they can, of course, go to the Amazon sales pages, and there's an author page on Amazon or something, which will list all of my previous titles, which many of which at least are in this general genre.
All right.
Yes, they are.
All right. As always, you are welcome back anytime. We love having you. We will be in touch with you regarding the stuff we were talking about before the show. And thank you for being on. You're always so much fun.
Yes, let's not forget the next time. Yes.
Great. It was my pleasure.
A lot of fun.
So,
okay, and I will see
anytime.
You soon.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Until next week, we wish you haunted nights.
And sweet screams.
Thank you for listening.
Haunted Nights, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.